I want to continue today. First half of the talk will be about case of triples. And in the second half, I'll talk about holomorphic bundles, GDC bundles, on an elliptic curve. So we'll begin with the simplest of all elliptically fibered manifolds, an elliptic curve, and study the situation there, and then tomorrow I will generalize to families of elliptic curves. So in commuting triples, I'll begin by talking about how we index the components of the moduli space. And then I'll talk a little bit about the nature of the components, structure of components. And then lastly, I'll talk about, I'm not sure what to call it, Witten's conjecture, Witten's observation. He stated it as something that had to be true and checked many examples to see that it was true. What? Right. Assertion? Okay. Well, it's more than an assertion. It was backed up with some evidence of various kinds. All right. So let me tell you, so the first somewhat surprising fact about commuting triples is the following. If I look at, so I'm now considering, well, if you want to think of it geometrically, I'm thinking of flat connections over the three torus, but the way we were doing everything last time, I'll continue. I'm thinking about three elements in the Lie group that commute. My Lie group is still G, it's simply connected and simple for most of the time. I'll say something about the non-simply connected case. Yeah. Anyway, I have three elements in G that commute with each other, and I want to study these up to simultaneous conjugation, so I get a moduli space of triples. Maybe I should call it T for triples, which of course depends on the group G. Now, if G is simply connected, as I'm assuming right now, there's only one topological type. Trivial bundle is the only G bundle over the three torus. That, of course, changes at the four torus. You have one characteristic class that goes with the second Casimir, some analog of the second Chern class. And then, that a non-trivial bundle like that will not have a flat connection. So if you're looking at flat connections over the four torus, there'll again only be one topological possibility for the bundle. That will eventually change, and I haven't checked, but it probably changes over the five torus. Anyway, there are certainly non-trivial topological bundles with no characteristic classes, whether or not they have flat connections. I haven't really tried to sort out. But anyway, on the three torus, there's only one topological type. It's got to be the trivial bundle. Nevertheless, this moduli of flat connections is disconnected in general. Unlike what happens in the case of T2, and unlike what happens for the case of SUN. So let's just contrast G with the simplest of all possible Gs, An minus 1 or SUN. There we know if you have any number of commuting matrices in SUN, they're simultaneously diagonalizable. Therefore, they can all be put in a single maximal torus, and the moduli space in this case for N tuples some quotient of the maximal torus with itself n times modulo some Lie group. And in particular, it's connected. will always be, if we go back to triples, there will always be a component like this of triples. So one of the components of this moduli space, T, will always be the component where X, Y, and Z can be simultaneously diagonalized, simultaneously put in the maximal torus. Again, the only indeterminacy is the vowel group, and so this will be one component. The largest component. There'll be other components of different dimensions. So let me tell you how to index the components. The components are indexed by pairs, K and mu. So K is a positive integer, and K divides Gi for some I. So this is notation left over from yesterday. I have fixed a group, a simple group. It has then a set of collection of co-root integers, and those are these are the numbers here. So G naught, which is 1, and I have G1, Gr. These are the co-root. So the first part of the indexing set is simply a positive integer that divides one of these co-root integers. You might think of those as exceptional integers associated to this group. And the second element in this set is a primitive. So it's an element in the U mod Z, or the circle, and it's a primitive kth root. Now, in this indexing, one possibility that you always have, if you think about these numbers, is k equal 1, and there's only one primitive first root of the unit. So there's one component associated with the integer k. That's this component. So this is the component indexed by 1, 1. But as long as one of the co-root integers is bigger than 1, we'll have other components. So just as a couple of examples, if I do spin 2n, which of course is dn, if you remember your Lincoln diagrams, it's like that. So I'm going to have, in this case, k will have to be 1 or 2, and so there are two components. 1, 1, and 2, a half. If I did, just to do one more, E6. In this case, I'll have, let me just list the components. Well, I have this component that we always have, T cross T cross T mod the vowel group. Then I have an analog of this component, 2.5, and then I have two components that start with 3. So I have 4 components. All right. Now, what do these components look like? Well, it's a general fact that no matter how many elements, commuting elements you have, whether or not the group is simply connected or not, every component has a structure which generalizes what we see here. So every component is of the form some torus cross torus cross torus mod finite group, where S is a subtorus of T. And it's 3 copies of S because I'm specializing in the case of 3 elements. If I were doing n elements, the structure would be n copies of some torus modifying group. So what I need to describe these components, these they're what they look like topologically or analytically. I need to tell you for each pair consisting of K and U, I need to find for you a subtorus inside T and describe the finite group and the way it acts. And that will then completely determine the structure of the components, particularly the dimension of the component will be three times the dimension of the torus. So let's take an S that goes with a component indexed by K and mu, and let's at least say what its dimension is first. Well, its dimension depends only on K. It turns out not to depend on this primitive K through its unity. In fact, the whole torus depends only on K. It's the number of indices in this set with the property that K divides GI minus 1. The minus 1 because I'm working here with the extended set, so I have one extra root or co-root, so I see these minus 1s a lot. So I simply take the number of the G's divisible by K, or the number of indices for which the corresponding G is divisible by this integer K, and the dimension of my torus is one less than that. So over here in Dn, that's the dimension of S, and therefore the dimension of the component is three times that dimension of the K mu component, then will be three times this number. Since it's three copies of S multiplied. So the dimensions over here, maybe I'll write the dimensions of the I'll write the dimensions of the tori. So of course the 1-1 component is the maximal torus. Let's just check that. Every GI is divisible by 1, so here I have the full set of extended simple roots, minus 1, that's the rank of the group. So the dimension here is, of course, 3n, if I do the component. The dimension here, I'm supposed to take the number of 2's minus 1. Well, that's codimension 4 here. So this is 3 times n minus 4. Those are the dimensions of those two components. If I look at these for E6, question? Right. Ah, you're right. No, but then I have to subtract another 1. So I have n minus 4 here, n minus 3 here, and then minus 1 more. It's codimension 4, and then we're going to come to that in just a second. All right, so let me now record the dimensions of these components in E6. This one, of course, is, again, goes with a maximal torus, so it's 18-dimensional. There are 3 2's in this diagram. That gives me a 2-dimensional torus, so this is a 6-dimensional component. There's 1, 3, and therefore these are 0-dimensional components. Notice that if I tried to extend this definition to other K, I would put here dimension minus 1, and that, of course, is true. All the other components are empty. So in some sense, it works even without this condition on K. S is a torus, yes. It's a torus. Yeah, these are components. Now, what torus is it? Well, of course, it's... really only defined up to conjugation, but I'm going to give you one representative for it. So first, a definition that is not too helpful as far as discovering what it is, but let me tell you formally how S is related to this triple X, Y, and Z. So you begin with the triple X, Y, and Z. You take its centralizer in the group. So the things that commute with X, Y, and Z, that's some subgroup of the group. And S is a maximal torus. dimension of S is the rank of this group. In the case when you could put all these elements in a maximal torus, then that torus would be inside the centralizer and thus would be a maximal torus for the centralizer, and I would recover for the components where X, Y, and Z are all in the torus, this would just be the torus. Or anything I need to. In general, these elements have, the centralizer has smaller rank, and the maximal torus is smaller dimensional. That's its formal dimension, you know, formal definition. Now, it turns out that this torus, by the way it's defined, has a special property. And there's only, up to conjugation in the original group G, finitely many possibilities for a tori like this, up to conjugation. A torus like this. One that's the maximal torus of the centralizer of some subset has only finitely many possibilities. Every torus like this arises up to conjugation in the following way. You take a subset I in the set of simple roots. And you take the intersection over these roots of the kernels. There's a linear subspace inside the Lie algebra. And then, let's call that frac S, and then the torus is simply the exponential of this linear subspace. So in fact, tori of this type are indexed by subsets of the set of simple roots. Okay, the two extremes, if this set is empty, we get back the maximal torus. If this set is the full set of simple roots, we get the trivial torus, one point. And we can get various sets in between. All right? So now let me tell you given an integer k and mu, which is not relevant for this part of the discussion, what the torus is. What I inside the set of simple roots goes with the K mu component. So if I have a triple XYZ that's in the component that I've labeled K mu, it's going to correspond, then it's going to be described as a kernel of some set of roots, and I want to know what the set is. Well, you simply, the set I is the set of, I don't know how to say this because of my notation. It's the roots A such that K does not divide GA. Sorry, that's not right. I want to look at this set. Look at the set of A. So look at the set of A, an extended simple root. So in this set, well, it's gone now. I have minus the dominant and minus the highest root and then my set of simple roots. In that collection, and then we have associated these integers, G0, which is 1, G1, GR. So each root in the set comes associated, has an integer associated with it. I want to take those whose integer is not divisible by K, and I want to take, let's call that I tilde of K, and let's take the intersection over these roots of the kernel. And that's S. So I haven't quite described it as I did over here. I have explicitly described it as an intersection of kernels of roots, but they're not a set of roots, of simple roots. They're a set of roots including the dominant root. In fact, because the coefficient of the dominant root is 1, it always appears in this set. Nevertheless, there is another way to rewrite this same linear subspace as an intersection of kernels of simple roots. So let me give you an example of how this works back to the Vn. So here's the extended diagram for Dn, and I'm looking for the torus S2 1/2. Well, it's the Lie algebra. The algebra of this torus is up to conjugation simply the kernel of the dominant root intersect A1, An minus 1, and An. Kernel A1 intersect kernel An minus 1 intersect kernel An. So the codimension 4 subspace, the subspace perpendicular to the four roots labeled 1. And those roots make a subdiagram product of 4 A1s. I have told you this torus can also be written up to conjugation as the kernel of some set of simple roots, and the simple roots are simply the D4 inside Dn. So take these four simple roots and take their kernel. You'll get a codimension 4 subspace conjugate to this one. And under that conjugation, these four A1s become the obvious four A1s inside D. If you extend the D4, you have four A1s, and those four A1s are these. So I have two different descriptions. The nicest description in terms of the original Dinkin diagram and the numbers is simply take the kernels of all the roots whose coefficients are not divisible, in this case by 2, or in general by k, but there is another description. And notice it does give a codimension 4 torus. I took 4 roots, so I'll get a codimension 4. It doesn't. So S of K mu is independent of mu. So in fact, the nature of the component depends only on K. You have to then replicate that component a certain number of times, depending on how many primitive roots you have. But topologically, they're the same component. Of course, the elements are different. I haven't told you what the elements, the normal form of the elements look like yet. Let me shift a little bit and talk about how, so now that I've described in some detail anyway, what these components look like and how you find them. Yes. Yeah, so we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. In fact, I may not have to talk about this at all. But in fact, there's another way to just, you have this torus S. There is perpendicular to S a subgroup, and we've just talked about its roots here. So in this case, it would be D4. And the triple, there's a rigid triple in this subgroup with the same integer. And then all you're allowed to do is move that rigid triple along S. So this triple has to be, by rigid I mean rank 0, and therefore the diagram here has to have the integer k appearing exactly 1. In fact, I know what subgroups I can get here. I can get, for 2, I can get B3 and D4 and G2. Depending on which one you're going to get as a subgroup, it's just whether or not your group is simply laced, doubly laced, or triply laced. For 3, I can only get E6 and F4, and again, simply laced or doubly laced. For 7, for 4, you get E7, and for 5 and 6, you get E8. So I know what the group is going to be. So there's a magical relationship between the numbers here and this special collection of groups, which isn't so obvious. All right. Let me go back and show you how this description is related to the weighted projective space that I was talking about yesterday. And let me do it, say, in the case of E6. So in E6, we found for pairs of elements a weighted projective space of dimension 6, of course. It had a P2, which I labeled 2, and a single point that I labeled 3. These were the exceptional orbits, the Z2 orbits and the Z3 orbits. And I told you along this projective space, the pinod of the centralizer of X and Y was a two-component group. And here, that pinod of the centralizer was the cyclic group of order 3, whereas generically the centralizer is connected. So let's think about our triple, X, Y, and Z. Well, first of all, it's got a pair, X and Y, which will produce some point in this projective space. And then it has a Z, which of course has to be in the centralizer. If I'm out here at a generic point, Z is in the component of the identity of the centralizer because that's all there is. And therefore, its conjugate inside the centralizer into the maximal torus. And therefore, all three elements are in the maximal torus, and the points X, Y, and Z sitting above X and Y out here, in fact, are in the big component, T cross T cross T, my dummy. But if I happen to be so lucky that X and Y were right here, well, I could still, now I have two components for the centralizer. If Z is in the component of the identity, I'm really back in the other component, and I can then deform out. But if Z happened to be in the non-trivial component, in fact, you cannot deform out. That Z forces you to, allows you to move only along this locus, in which case you keep two components. And X and Y are then forced to stay here, and Z is forced to remain in the non-trivial component. So that's the component labeled 2 1/2. The 1/2 here refers to the fact that Z is an element of order 2 in this component. Similarly, if I happen to be, X and Y happen to be at this point, the centralizer is a group of order 3. In fact, the centralizer is Z mod 3. That's right, so the maximal torus extended by Z mod 3. But the Z mod 3 is acting without plus 1 eigenspace on the maximal torus. So if I put Z in either of the other components, the non-trivial components, X and Y can't move off of this point and still commute with Z. And therefore, X and Y are rigid, and I have two possibilities for Z, depending on the two components. And these are the components that I labeled 3 1/3 and 3 2/3. And you'll check that the dimensions are right. I had a six-dimensional component associated with this. Well, X and Y are free to run over this real four space, and Z also has 2 degrees of freedom. This is a zero-dimensional component. Now you might ask about, how do I distinguish between 1/3 and 2/3? What's really the difference? And the answer there is the Chern-Simons invariant. So any flat connection is simple here. On T3 has a Chern-Simons invariant, which is element circle, R mod Z. So the first result is that, in fact, on a component indexed by K mu, the Chern-Simons invariant is a primitive K root of unity. And thus, we take mu to be that K root of unity. So the way we decide what K root of unity to put with which component is we take the Chern-Simons invariant on that component. I guess I should have said, first of all, Chern-Simons invariant is defined for a flat connection. If you, the flat connections are the critical points of Chern-Simons. So if you move in a component of flat connections, the Chern-Simons invariant doesn't change. You're moving in the critical set of the function. So it's constant on components. So I can talk about its value on each component. And this is the value, which is always a primitive root of unity of the right order. So in fact, I have two, in this case of Z3 and E6, I have two components. They're both points, is a single triple in, of the conjugation in each for each component, and the way I distinguish between those triples is by the Chern-Simons invariant. Of course, if XYZ represents one component, then XYZ squared represents the other. And it's pretty easy to see that if you replace Z by Z squared, you will double the Chern-Simons invariant. So if one of them is a primitive third root of unity, the other is the other primitive third root of unity. So that's how these components that I've talked about over here as tori are related to this stratification of the weighted projectors. Well, in terms of the triple, we've now given another definition. You take this element Z, thought of as an element in pi naught of the centralizer of X and Y, and you see what its order is. Now, that looks very asymmetric, but in fact, it's independent of the way you've chosen to order the elements. So I'm not sure that answers your question. Let me just say a few more words about the structure of the components. I haven't talked about the finite group that you divide out by. It can get a little complicated, especially in the non-simply connected case, but in the simply connected case, it's in fact all the components. So G is simply connected. Each component is of the form called S bar cross S bar cross S bar mod the vial group of S. In fact, I can explicitly identify the components. Here, S bar, we have the subtorus S. It's the image under the exponential map of a linear subspace. Take the perpendicular linear subspace and take the image of it under the exponential map. Call that S perp. These linear subspaces, of course, meet transversely, but these tori don't. They'll meet in a finite set of points, which you can compute from the lattice theory. And S bar is simply S mod this intersection. So that's what S bar is. It's a finite quotient of S, and then you divide out by the vial group of S. This, by definition, is simply the normalizer of S and the full group divided by the centralizer. It's always a finite group. Generalizes the vial group of the maximal torus. When G is non-simply connected, you don't have the full symmetry between the three elements, and you get slightly different results. For example, for a non-simply connected group, you can get answers like this. The elements play slightly different roles. But anyway, you can explicitly work out what these finite groups are and explicitly understand the components. So this would be a non-simply connected example. By the way, I guess I should say, I don't really have time to say much about this, but the non-simply connected case works exactly like the simply connected case. You use, however, the quotient Dynkin diagram and the induced integers G bar. But the recipes that I gave you for how to find the dimensions of the torus, how to find the tori, so on, all go through exactly the same. The finite group can be, as I said, a little more complicated to sort out. All right, well, I want to finish discussion of triples of elements with Witten's conjecture about the way these moduli spaces fit together. And I want to begin with a group theoretic fact, which is a numerical property of the integers, the co-root integers, in fact the root integers too, which is proved in the group theory. So it's the following properties. Take any integer k that divides some gi. K greater than or equal to 1. So fix k like that. Now remove from the extended Dynkin diagram all the vertices divisible whose integer is divisible by k. So remove all vertices A such that the co-root integer GA is divisible by K. First of all, what's left is a disjoint union of A n's. So you'll get chains on when you do this. Let's call them AJs. J plus 1 has to divide, get this right now, divides K. And if you look at the remaining integers and the remaining, and the integers on the remaining vertices, taken modulo k, form a, say a linear series. Maybe rather than trying to say it better in words, I'll just show you in the examples what I mean. So, first of all, the case when k is equal to 2, what does this say? It says if you remove all the even labels on the diagram, what's left is a product of A1s, and they have, this doesn't say anything, the remaining integers are odd, taken mod 2, they're 1. No information. The only information is you get A1 chains. And if you look, for example, at EA, just for fun, you remove the even ones, you get a bunch of A1s. Let's try K equals 3. Well, you remove all the vertices whose integers are divisible by 3, assuming there is at least 1. What's got to be left are A1s and A2s, but they all have to be A2s because of this divisibility condition, and the numbers taken mod 3 have to be 1, 2. So, for example, that's exactly what you get in E6. If you remove the 3, you get 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. You get 3 A1s with labels 1, 2. Maybe a little more interesting to do E8 and 3. Let's see what we get there. If you remove the labels divisible by 3, that's this one, and this one. And I get 2 A1s, the 3 A1s. And you'll notice taken mod 3, the numbers are 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. One last example where things get a little more interesting from the numbers. Let's do E8 and 6. Well, there's only one vertex divisible by 6. That's this one. I get A chains. I get an A5, an A2, and an A1. And 6, 3, and 2 are the possible divisors of 6. Here are the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, as advertised. Here's the linear series 2, 4, 6. And here's 3. So these numbers have to be mod 6, 2, and 4, and 3. That's a numerical, magical numerical property that these diagrams have. By the way, that property alone forces the maximum value on the diagram to be one, two, three, four, or six. If you look for sets of integers with this property, you will find, and you cut out the GCD. I mean, I always have a one in these diagrams. So divide by greatest common divisor. Divide out by the greatest common divisor so that at least one of the numbers turns out has to be 1, then the maximum number that you'll find is 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6. And these are basic, the Dinkin diagrams are basically the only solutions to this numerical criterion. Okay. That strange-sounding numerical criterion is and the information I've given you about the dimensions of the components and the Chern-Simons invariant is equivalent to the following statement. Completely equivalent. And this is Witten's conjecture. On the circle, for each component of moduli, so I go back to my moduli space, for each component M, it has a Chern-Simons, X has a Chern-Simons, some root of unity on the circle. That's going to be the center of what I do for X. And now I space equally around the center of X one more than the dimension of the torus. Okay, so I put dimension of S plus 1 points here with spacing 1 over G. Dual constant. So this is the Chern-Simons of X. So if this dimension plus 1 was even, I wouldn't actually have a dot here. If it's odd, I would have a dot here. I do that for every component, and I get then a finite subset of the circle, and Witten's conjecture was that subset is invariant under rotation by 1 over G. 1 over G. So let's just do E6, for example. So E6, I have... that's right. January, a year and a half ago. That's right. I think he asserted it was true in this room. Anyway, let's do E6. So we have the component of the identity. It's going to be centered over here at 1, which is its Chern-Simons invariant. And it had dimension 6. So I put points 1. Let me forget the 1 over G. We'll see how that works. 1, 0, 1, 2, 3. Since I know the code number here is 12, let me just... So that's what goes with the identity component, the big component. Now I have the component whose Chern-Simons is a half, and it was dimension, its torus was dimension 2, so I put 3 points here. And then I have two components that go with 3. They're both of dimension 0, so they add only 1 point, and they add it at the 2/3 roots of unity. And as you'll see, not by my metric, by my numerology, it works. Every integer is accounted for exactly once, between 1 and 12. It's fun to do E8, but I don't think I have time. E8 is magical. Anyway, this condition is equivalent, as I said, to the computation of the Chern-Simons, the computation of the dimensions of the various tori, and this simple numerical fact that was decided. Maybe a word about how Ed was led to this conjecture. And here I'm on pretty shaky ground, but he was looking, not surprisingly from the discussion, at a G gauge theory over the three torus. Probably some supersymmetric version of it. This is going to be an R symmetry. And he then let the volume of the torus go to infinity, and what was an R symmetry of a circle was broken down to an R symmetry group of twice the dual Coxeter number. So this, he then knew that some space of vacua had to be invariant under this kind of rotation, and he identified the space of vacua with the union over the components of moduli of something, and what goes with each component is somehow as I've displayed them here. Now, maybe there's somebody out there that can say better words about this than me. That's my understanding. Anybody want to add a little bit for the general edification? Anyway, that's how he was led to this symmetry, was through seeing our symmetry broken down and knowing he needed a dual cognitive symmetry. This, in mathematics, is probably not going to be hugely important. Your symmetry is hugely important in mathematics. Nevertheless, it seems to me to capture this funny interaction between mathematics and physics. I mean, here it is. I knew this numerical property. I knew how to calculate all these dimensions. I knew all these moduli spaces. I would have never in a million years formulated this. I never would have thought to look for this kind of symmetry. Ever. Once Ed told me it was true, it was 10 minutes. I mean, I immediately somehow knew that this numerology here was what was important. So the tools were already in place. I knew the theorem in some sense, I just didn't know the formulation. Now often we don't know how to prove it, and after we hear this beautiful, mysterious formulation, we go home and work very hard, and mirror symmetry being the counterexample, we tend to be able to prove it. But we never understand the mystery. I mean, where it comes from in the first place is such a mystery. That's the magic of this stuff from my perspective. And this is a very simple and probably not all that important, but it somehow it's a paradigm. It has that feeling to it. Okay. Enough of that. Let's switch gears now completely and talk about elliptic curves. This is, of course, much more closely related to what I was saying yesterday about pairs of elements, which is the case of the two torus. And this discussion about the three torus isn't really relevant for what's going to happen here. Well, maybe I should start by just, give you a definition. So we're going to consider now, we started with a compact, simple group G. Since we're going to be talking about holomorphic bundles, we have to take the complex form of that group. If I had started with the most classical of all groups, SUN, I would, of course, get SLNC. The symplectic group, I guess, has a name. E6 doesn't really have a name. It doesn't have another name over on the complex side. Anyway, I'm taking the complex semi-simple group associated with this compact group. That's GC, and I want to look at holomorphic GC bundles, principal GC bundles over an elliptic curve. And for various reasons, the notions of stability, which come up all over the place in this kind of mathematics and the singularity classification of curves and so on, is important here, and the appropriate notion turns out to be semi-stability. Because over the torus, it turns out there are no properly stable objects, with very trivial exceptions. And one has to work with semi-stable rather than stable objects. So we're going to say that a principal GC bundle over an elliptic curve is semi-stable if its adjoint bundle is, as a vector bundle. Should I remind you what it means for a vector bundle to be semi-stable? Okay. So that's a more classical notion, and we have generalized it to an arbitrary group by this simple mechanism. So a vector bundle over an elliptic curve, or over any curve, so this is a vector bundle over a curve, has a slope, and the slope of V, it's often called mu of V, different from the mu had on the board a few minutes ago, is simply the degree of V over the rank. So if V were split as a sum of line bundles, it would be the average degree of those line bundles. One looks in studying stability at sub-bundles. So since we have a curve, in fact, I can really take honest sub-bundles. I don't have to talk about sheaves. It's real, the most naive sense, a sub-bundle. You know, at every point, you have a linear subspace and dimensions. Well, dimensions not varying in the space, varying homomorphically. Well, I can compare the average slope, well, the slope of mu with the slope of v, and I guess I say that if this inequality always holds for all subbundles W in V, then V is semi-stable. It's probably, if you haven't heard this notion before, not apparent to you why this notion is worth anything, reasonable. It's not completely apparent to me, except I know technically how it works. It's not obvious on the face of it that this is an interesting notion, but this is the right notion. By the way, you would call a bundle stable if you always had strict inequality. Over an elliptic curve, you can classify all bundles, semi-stable or not, and Atiyah did that over 40 years ago, but when you try to fit them together into a moduli space, you have to restrict to the special bundles, semi-stable bundles. Even when you restrict the semi-stable bundles, you have the same sort of non-Hausdorff phenomenon that Dave talked about surfaces. And let me give you the simplest example of the non-Hausdorff phenomenon. Let's consider bundles over the elliptic curve, which are extensions. I slipped sheaves in, I'm sorry. This is the trivial bundle, this is the trivial bundle, and this is some rank 2 bundle. Such extensions are classified by the cohomology of the H1 of the elliptic curve with the dual of this one tensor this one, which is just the trivial line bundle. And of course, because we have an elliptic curve, we have a holomorphic differential, anti-holomorphic differential. This group is rank 1. So there is a one-dimensional family of extensions like this, all of them non-trivial except, of course, the zero class, which is the trivial extension. But as you scale the extension class, you don't really change the isomorphism class of the middle. So there are really two objects here, like this. So if I think about the space, the parameter space C, over the origin I have the split bundle O plus O. Everywhere else I have this non-trivial extension. They're all the non-trivial extensions are isomorphic, and that's what I'll call I2. So if I had a parameter space of these and these bundles are all clearly semi-stable. So if I had a parameter space of these bundles, I have the same non-Hausdorff phenomenon that we saw the other day in Dave's lecture. This point would have to be in the closure of that one. So you couldn't put an open set around O plus O that missed I2. Well, that's not something we want to try to deal with, and the way out of it here is to introduce a notion of S equivalence. And F equivalence simply says I2 and O plus O are to be identified. In some sense, what you do is you just cancel out this non-Hausdorffness. Anytime you have a family of semi-stable bundles, all of them isomorphic to a given bundle except one or a finite number, you then say the generic one is equivalent, so it probably won't be isomorphic, to the special one. So it's a generalization of what happened here. And we then have a good moduli space. I guess, in fact, it's going to be coarse rather than fine, of S equivalence classes. Of semi-stable reasonable collection, reasonable class of objects. It's moduli space is a nice holomorphic manifold, holomorphic complex variety. And in fact, we know what it looks like in this case through an old theorem of Narasimhan and Seshadri. It's a theorem over all curves, not just elliptic curves, and usually it deals with stable rather than semi-stable objects, but if you extend it in the obvious way, you find that the moduli space of S equivalence classes of semi-stable GC bundles is isomorphic to the space of flat G bundles. So you pass between this complex group and holomorphic bundles, semi-stable ones, and flat bundles with the complex group, with the compact group. The easiest map to define goes from the flat connection to the bundle. Given a flat G connection, that's a principal G bundle, you can simply extend from G to GC. You now have a principal GC bundle, which is flat, and therefore naturally has a holomorphic connection to D bar operator. So that's the map in this direction. It's a classical and beautiful computation. I'm sure you're familiar to the physicists. That bundle has to be semi-stable. In fact, it has to be a Dirac sum of stable bundles. We're doing vector bundles. And the theorem is that you account for every S equivalence class uniquely this way. So every S equivalence class has in it a unique representative with a flat connection over the compact group. Doing the classical case of vector bundles and, in fact, rank two bundles, and I ask about this S equivalence class, of course, it's O plus O. The split one has a flat connection. I2 does not. And in general, for vector bundles, the semi-stable vector bundles that support a flat SUN connection are Dirac sums of line bundles, more generally, for SUN, it's Dirac sums of line bundles of degree zero. Semi-stability says they all have to have the same degree, all degree zero. Those are the ones that emit flat SUN connections. If you ask about other representatives in the same S equivalence class, what can happen is, well, if these line bundles are non-isomorphic, nothing can happen. That's the only representative in the class. There's no other choice. But if, say, two of these line bundles were isomorphic, you could do exactly what I did over here. Take an extension of L by L, or tensor I2 with L, or take L plus L. If you had three of them, there were several things you could do. You could put all three of them together in one long chain, or put two of them together plus L and take three copies of them, and so on. So you have lots of different representatives. They all, in the end, come from things like this and then longer chains. But the ones that have flat connections are the Dirac sums of line bundles. So, in fact, this moduli space is a weighted projective space, because we've already computed, Lenka computed for us, what the space of flat connections look like. So the moduli space of S equivalence classes. Semi-stable GC bundles is a WP1 GR, where these again are the coroute integers. Maybe it isn't completely clear from what I've said that the holomorphic structure that comes from this description is a moduli problem agrees with the holomorphic structure we had yesterday through the Lenkis theorem, but they do agree. I want to describe this space a different way. And it will turn out that we'll be describing the moduli space of S equivalence classes of semi-stable bundles. I will be getting a weighted projective space, but I will not be getting the same set of representatives. I will be getting a different set of representatives through this construction. And when we go to move in families, it turns out that the representatives will get through the second construction very much more naturally than the sums of line bundles. And this is, in fact, related to the question that Dan was asking yesterday about the automorphism groups. So we're going to find families whose automorphism groups behave much better, and therefore they fit together, family of bundles whose automorphism groups behave much better. So they'll fit together in families over moving elliptic curves in a much better way. And this is called a parabolic construction. So it's going to give us, as I said, a way to construct bundles over elliptic curves. It turns out a natural generalization or a straightforward generalization will allow us to do this construction over families as well. Let me begin with the case of vector bundles first, and then I'll probably all I'll be able to do today, and the next time I'll start with the analog of this for a general group. So I want to construct an SLN bundle over E, a semi-stable one, and the way I'm going to do it is start with a minimally unstable, start with an object that's minimally unstable. And the way I do it is this. For each integer k, I'm going to construct a bundle wk over the elliptic curve. It's going to have degree 1. And it's going to have rank k, of course. And its determinant is going to be, it's going to be the line bundle O of p naught. P naught here is the base point, the origin in the elliptic curve. And in fact, this bundle is closely related to these bundles I2 or IN that I've talked about just a few minutes ago. It's going to be written as a series of extensions. At the end, you'll have O of P naught, and we'll have W2, the kernel is O. So if you calculate the cohomology over the elliptic curve of the dual of this H1 of the dual of this tends to this, you'll find out it's one-dimensional. So there's a unique non-trivial extension. That's W2. W3 is obtained by, again, extending by O of E. Once again, a simple calculation, cohomological computation shows you the number of extensions here. Dimension of the number of extensions is 1. So you have one non-trivial extension, and you keep going. So Wn will be filtered, and the associated gradeds will be all O's except the very last one, which will be the line bundle of degree 1. And there is a unique such bundle that at each stage is a non-trivial extension. And that's the bundle WK. There's one of those for each integer K. And here I make a bundle. This is the dual WK star plus WN minus K. This is a rank N bundle. Since the determinants here are opposite, it's in fact an SLN bundle. It's got trivial determinants. But it's obviously unstable. It's a bundle of degree 0, so its slope is 0, but it contains this guy as a subbundle, and it has degree 1. So it's slightly unstable. It's so very slightly unstable that if we consider vector bundles, which are extensions like this, so instead of considering the split one, let's consider bundles that are extensions of this by that. What I said about the determinant and rank, of course, don't change. The non-trivial extension won't affect either of those computations. So V is an SLN bundle. And as long as the extension is non-trivial, it is stable. Not semi-stable. So the split extension, well, that's the one we started with, is unstable, but as long as you make it non-split, so you can't pull W n minus k back in here, there's nothing that can destabilize this bundle. Maybe I'll prove that for you. I just need a little room. So suppose I have a sub-bundle destabilizing V. Well, then I know mu of x has to be greater than mu of v, which is 0, so mu of x is positive. That means the degree of x is at least 1. Get a little room here. So let's look at wk star intersect x. This is a subbundle of WK star, which is stable of degree minus 1. So this has negative degree, or is trivial. And therefore, it's not all of X. That is to say, this map X has a non-trivial image in WN minus K. In fact, this had negative slope. This has positive slope, so this has positive slope. Well, W is stable of slope 1 over n minus k, and this has positive slope and rank at most n minus k. And it's non-trivial. So the only possibility is, in fact, that it's equal to Wn minus k. Anything else would destabilize Wn minus k. And that means mu of this is 0, because these two have the same, well, it means mu of this is 0, or less than or equal to 0. So it would destabilize this unless it's 0. In fact, the only way I can destabilize V is to have X equal to Wn minus K, and I split the sequence. Just simple numerical computations like that. Okay, so that implies that X is a splitting of the sequence. So as long as the sequence is not split, V is a semi-stable bundle. So in this way, I get a family of semi-stable bundles parameterized by the extensions, which is the first cohomology of Wn minus k star tensor Wk star. Well, I have to take the non-trivial extensions, and as usual in extension theory, multiplying the extension by a scalar doesn't change the isomorphism class of the bundle. So I get a projective space here, and you do a simple computation of the dimension of this cohomology group. This has dimension n. So this is a projective space of dimension n minus 1. It's an ordinary projective space. And every point in this projective space is parameterizing a semi-stable bundle. So I can map this projective space to the moduli space of semi-stable bundles. Well, here I have a projective space. Here I have, by something I know by the Lange theorem, is a projective space. And it's not too hard to show directly, in fact, that this is an isomorphism. So this is another description of the space of bundles. Now, I said, okay, so I found another way to obtain unique representatives for each S-equivalence class of semi-stable SLN bundles. I told you these were different representatives than the flat ones. And the reason is that it's easy to see from the definition of V, that in fact V is what's called a regular bundle. And the definition of that is that the automorphism group of V has dimension if you think about, let's do a simple computation. If I think about O plus O, its automorphism group is GL2 at dimension 4. GL2 of C, dimension 4. It turns out if you look at I2, which is an extension of O by O, turns out that its automorphism group looks like C of T modulo T squared. Not too hard to show that. And thus has dimension 2. So in fact, this representative is the regular one. The split representative has a much larger automorphism group. And if you think about sums of line bundles, if they're all distinct, the automorphism group can't mix the line bundles of degree 0, so the automorphism group is simply a product of n C stars, which is dimension n. If two of them become the same, you have the same GL2, but if you replace it by the I2 version, you'll only get a two-dimensional space there. So the regular bundles are the ones where you amalgamate all the isomorphic line bundles together in one indecomposable piece. The split one is where you split them apart as much as possible into a direct sum of line bundles. So in some sense, these representatives are at the other extreme from the sum of line bundles. Generically, of course, there's only one representative. They agree. It's only in codimension 1 where they begin to agree, and in higher codimension where they get further and further apart. So in fact, this is a family of regular semistable vector bundles. So every S equivalence class of semistable vector bundles has two natural representatives. It has the split representative from the flat connection, and it has a regular, unique regular representative. And we have two constructions, one from the connection theory that produces the split one, and this from the parabolic or extension point of view that produces the one at the other extreme, the regular one. So I'll continue with this with other groups next time, and then we'll do families.